Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 39 for March 15th, 2013. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I am happy to have you with me as always. This is the second in a series of roundtable discussions with a variety of critics and journalists and game developers, all focused on the state of games. I hope you'll check out the previous show, episode 38, in which I launched the series and describe what we're up to in these conversations. And I hope you'll stay tuned for the final two installments, which I'll release over the coming days. In this episode, I'm joined by Chris Sullentrop, video game reviewer for the New York Times, deputy news editor at Yahoo, and a freelance writer for many other publications, and by Steve Gaynor of the Fulbright Company, an indie game studio developing a new game called Gone Home, which I think anyone listening to this podcast will be sure to find interesting. It's always great to have Steve on the show, and I'm grateful to both Steve and Chris for spending time with me and chatting with me about state of games. As always, I hope you enjoy the show, and away we go. I am delighted to welcome Steve Gaynor and Chris Sullentrop to the podcast. This is Chris's first visit, so a special welcome to you, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Steve, it's great to hear your voice again. It's been a while, but always great to have you on the show.
It has been a while. It's been years, but I'm excited to talk to you again.
Yeah, well, we got lots to talk about. just real quick, for those who might not know, Steve worked for several years on the BioShock series, first at 2K Marin and most recently at Irrational Games. And last year, he moved back to Portland to start up the Fulbright Company, a studio that he founded with a few of his friends and coworkers. And he's currently working on a new game called Gone Home, which, happy news for those who might not have heard, is a finalist for Excellence in Narrative at this year's Independent Games Festival. So that's fantastic. And again, Steve, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no, we're real excited about the award. Fingers crossed and everything. But it'll just be great to be there showing it to people at the IGF kiosk. It'll be a lot of fun. So
it'll be great to see you there. It'll be like an odd, I don't know. I've been going to that for a number of years, and I always hang out at those kiosks, and you know, you're actually going to be behind one of them now.
Yeah. It'll be weird, but it'll be good.
Well, we might get into a little bit of Gone Home just as a little kind of update on where you are, but I'd encourage everyone who might be in the vicinity and who's going to the show to definitely check it out. I've played up to the point that you've shown people the game. You've probably built more since then. But it's terrific. It's very exciting. In fact, I even shared it with some of my students and talked to Steve about that a little bit. And it's just a terrific game. I think I'm one of many people who are very excited about the release of that game.
Thank you, Mom.
And Mr. Chris Sullentrop is the deputy editor at Yahoo News. He is a freelance video game critic for the New York Times. One of his most recent pieces is about this really interesting exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, which we might talk about a little bit. He's written feature articles for the New York Times Magazine and Wired, Slate, among other places. And his essays have appeared in Rolling Stone and the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times. He's been in a lot of different places. And so it's great to have you on, Chris. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, no, it's an honor to be here.
Well, let's get right to it. My thesis here is that we are in a transitional period and we're moving into, well, who knows where? And I guess one place to start would be to sort of ask you if you see it that way. I mean, we often hear we're in a transitional period in games. Is this any different now? Is there anything actually happening that would make this transitional?
I would say so. And I think you make a fine point that it seems like we always are. And in a lot of ways, we probably, you know, in most times that you look at in the games industry, there are big changes going on, which is a good thing, I think, like that the industry is continuing to evolve and not just stagnate in the way that it makes games and gets them to people. I mean, you know, obviously I will cop to being biased from my own point of view, but I'm definitely excited to be in the middle of what I feel like is a big transition for the perception and the position of indie games in you know, the minds of players and in, like, the economic landscape of game development. Like, over the last few years, especially, you know, like, it's really ramped up over the last few years. I feel like the ability for indie companies to make games that lots of players are really excited about, and more importantly, to reduce the barriers of entry to get those games to people that are excited to play them, either through the methods of promotion that you have with stuff like Twitter and blogs like Rock Paper Shotgun, or, you know, through digital download services, which there are just more and more of, and also that Steam has just gotten better and better as a service and sort of paid attention to by more people. That stuff is all really exciting to me, because I think that, at least for me as a player, what I want out of video games is to find new, interesting, different stuff that isn't like what I've played before. And I just feel like we're in a state where more kinds of creators are more able to get more different, cool, new things to more people more easily. That's a lot of mores, but, like, I think that's really good, and I am excited to be part of it. You know, having gone indie just in the last year, like you noted, and I think it's just going to continue to shift the balance in that direction over time.
Do you need to be in the indie space for those changes to happen? I mean, is it a place that people are going to because it is the place where the most interesting changes are happening?
I think it's a lot easier. I think because when you're in the AAA space, what you do is determined in large part by publicly traded companies, and publicly traded companies are not designed to take risks. And, you know, I think it's strange, the definition of risk-taking that seems to be favored by large corporations, which is currently, it seems, mostly, let's make the biggest bet on the thing that we think can make the most money. Just make, you know, like, a few big bets that we think are very likely to succeed, versus making a lot of small bets that have lower return on investment, but are also, you know, less of a downside if they don't succeed. So I feel like currently, yeah, it is it's much harder to do something innovative or whatever, however you want to characterize it, if you're working for a large company that's publicly traded, than if you are independent and you have the luxury of making something that you're making because you want to make it and selling it directly to people who are interested in it through Steam or what have you. But I don't think that it has to, I don't know, it seems strange to me that it doesn't feel like it has to be that way, because if you look at, like, Double Fine, what they've done in the last 4 or 5 years, 3 or 4 years, where they have stopped making big single bets like Brutal Legend and started making a lot of smaller projects, I feel like if a large publisher took that approach, they might similarly find a lot more success than some of the big corporate publishers are currently having. And I think people would find more interesting stuff coming out of them more often than they currently do.
Yeah. It does seem like it's getting harder to distinguish between the AAA and the whatever you might want to call it. I mean, indie space is such a generic term for such a huge kind of multifarious series of activities that it's getting harder, I think, for the average gamer to really tell the difference between a AAA game and games that are significantly lower budgeted. Just the tools available to you and what you're able to, the distribution model that you were describing. I mean, I can get these games in my hands by just pressing a button, and it could be Diablo 3, or it could be some greenlit game.
Yeah, and I think that's good. I think that's important. Like, I think that games like Amnesia or, you know, The Witness or something that, you know, when you look at them and play them, they feel very rich, and they you feel like moment to moment you're having an experience that is equivalent to what you might have from, you know, a retail boxed game. I think that is. Yeah, I think it's great for that to be part of what is represented by the indie space, and not for indie games to be pigeonholed as, you know, like, oh, they're just glorified flash games or whatever, you know, because there is super great stuff, like Spelunky or Super Meat Boy that is very much in the vein of like 2D platformer stuff that is totally great and that people get excited about. But the diversity, I think, of how people think of what indie games can be has really increased in recent years. And yeah, if you feel like, hey, I can get an experience that gives me like the feelings and the value that I get out of a $60 game by playing this like smaller downloadable indie game, that's great, because just more people will, I think, be more interested in kind of giving indie games a chance if they know that there's more kinds of experiences that they can have within that sphere.
Yeah. What do you think, Chris?
I mean, I do think this question of what is an indie is an interesting one. And Steve would know more about this than I do from a practitioner's perspective. But if you're of a certain age, and I am of a certain age, you'll remember that music moved from college rock to alternative rock to basically everything that was popular was labeled alternative rock for a period. No, it was on everything on MTV, everything on FM radio. And we're not there yet with indie games, but it does seem to me it's more like 1993 than it is 1997, but it's more 1993 than it is 1985.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. And companies like Sony and Valve and to a lesser extent Microsoft are playing the role that Geffen and other labels did in that period, where they hoovered up these acts that previously were on labels like IRS, and then eventually those bands were on Warner Brothers, right? But I mean, obviously Jonathan Blow is an indie developer, right? But he relies quite heavily on Microsoft and Sony to distribute his work. My very favorite game of last year was Papo and Yo. I think that's indisputably an indie game, but also I think the muscle of Sony is I don't want to get into a business discussion, but is a clear explanation for its popularity as well as Journey, right? If that game company was just publishing these things to a website, sort of tale of tale style, which is not to compare their games necessarily, but they'd have a different audience.
Yeah, I mean, do you find as a writer that is there the same audience for you as a critic, particularly at the Times, but maybe other venues, for writing about indie games? Is it easier for you to make a case as a freelance writer to write about a AAA game that most people have heard of? Has that changed for you at all?
I think it's changed a little bit. I mean, I do think it is usually pretty easy to make a case for a hugely popular game. And that doesn't mean all AAA games, because not all AAA games are hugely popular, right? But it's easy to make a case for games that sell many, many, many millions of copies, or that involve popular, long-lived, older than a decade brands, right? But, I find there's a lot of interest right now in what indie designers are up to. You know, the New York Times Magazine ran a story on Dwarf Fortress. The Atlantic had its profile of Jonathan Blow. I reviewed Fez and Papo and Yo in full in the Times last year. It's a really interesting space creatively. The people are very interested in mobile and tablet games, many of which are made by indie designers. So I don't think it's more challenging to get a review. I think what's more challenging to get is the attention, right? I do think, at least for somebody like me who doesn't cover everything and only writes about, when I can and is not doing this full time, either I need, and this is hard to get in advance, a real strong sense that this is something excellent, or a sense that there's some, ineffable momentum behind it, or maybe effable momentum, if I could measure it in some way, to help make the sell that this is something that the Times in particular should pay attention to.
I'm really curious about that side of it. And Steve, you're probably kind of right in the middle of that. How do you, it's easy when you have a whole PR arm of the company, and the publishers out there, beating the bushes for you. How do you get people to pay attention to you? How do you get eyeballs on your project, basically?
I can only speak as an individual, right? Like I'm not giving advice to anybody else, because I can't really say, here's how you should get attention for your game. But like the biggest part of it is just putting yourself out there and trying to make people aware of you as an individual in whatever ways that you can, whether that's on Twitter or running a blog or whatever, and your project, by reaching out to journalists and letting them know what's interesting about it and giving them the opportunity to actually play it and form opinions of it and stuff. And obviously I have a number of advantages in that sphere, since, you know, like, I worked on BioShock 2 and BioShock Infinite, and we're making a game that's, you know, a first-person immersive exploration game that, you know, draws from our experience with that franchise. So there's this kind of built-in level of, oh, it's somebody who worked on BioShock and they're doing a thing that is kind of like that but different, you know. And there are some aspects of just my resume that I think make journalists a little bit more likely to perk their ears up and look at what we're doing. But, you know, even aside from that, I think that something that is great about games journalists is that, you know, game journalists are games enthusiasts, right? Like, games journalists love games and they're excited about them, and they have those same desires that, you know, I described earlier, to find things that they think are new and different and cool and exciting and that they want to play. And so I think that, you know, if you can make something that is new and different and that people can get excited about and do a good enough job of letting them know what is interesting about what you're doing and why they should pay attention to it, that's the kind of stuff that games journalists are looking for already, both as players and as fodder to write about. I've found, you know, journalists to be receptive to stuff that makes them personally excited and to champion that, which is great to see. But, you know, the biggest thing is just make something, you have to make something that is exciting and interesting to people aside from yourself, and then be able to get the word out about it and let people know about it and keep working on growing that momentum.
Yeah, no, it's true in any business, right? If you're not having fun, this is not just a rule for games. If you're not having fun, you're probably doing it wrong.
Yeah, and it is fun. I think partly what makes GDC so exciting is that everyone's there with a certain amount of passion behind what they're doing. Either they're advocating for change, or they're building something exciting, or they're trying to push the industry in a certain way, which requires a kind of energy. People have a variety of reasons for being there, but they all tend to be attached to something passionate. At least that's been my observation. How much of an actual difference does it make when The Atlantic or The New York Times or someplace does in fact feature a game? You mentioned Papo and Yo. Maybe that'd be a good example. You might not know the answer to this, Chris, but we have some sense of, like, with Minecraft, that went viral in the most wonderful sense of it. And, you know, he's a very rich man now, but that doesn't happen for everybody. And I'm wondering how much of a difference it actually does make to shine your big, bright mainstream media light on a game.
Yeah, probably very little. I mean, I think it's great. I mean, obviously, if I were a game maker, I'd want to be in that space. As a writer, I'm delighted to be in that space. Even in this fragmented media universe, it convenes a community of some kind that is large. But with exceptional circumstances, you know, one article isn't going to make or break anybody. It will create attention, right? Like, it will create, I think, the ability for somebody to give their attention to something, right? Maybe for a few seconds, that they maybe, oh, I saw that before somewhere. I don't even remember where. And that matters, right? But I am certainly not an expert in public relations. I should say to all PR people listening to this, it really matters. It's very important that I write an article about your product.
Yeah, I think that you're pointing to just, yeah, the general kind of ambient building of awareness, which I think is really important, you know, like, because just like you said, I think that, and there's, I don't know, Malcolm Gladwell or somebody's probably written about this, but there's this threshold past which you've heard about something enough times that your brain decides, oh, I guess I should be paying attention to that, you know?
Exactly.
And so, you know, with our game or whatever, if, you know, somebody sees an article or an interview or whatever about Gone Home, and they see it and they think, oh, this is like the third time I've heard about that. I guess people care about it. Maybe I should be paying attention to that. Then, you know, that's a cumulative effect, and that will lead you, that will lead an individual to, like, care enough about your game by the time it comes out to say, like, oh, that game I've heard of is coming out. Oh, people are saying it's good. Okay, maybe I should buy it, as opposed to, this is the first time I've ever even heard of that. I don't know what it is. Whatever. Forget about it. You know, even if you can't point to one single article correlating directly to, like, sales numbers or whatever, it's all, I think, about just keeping the game in people's heads and making it a familiar concept to them when they hear about it again and again over time.
So I see a certain disconnect, which is hard for me to understand completely. I see it mostly with my students. And so we're talking that sort of 18 to 21, 22 year old, mostly male demographic here. That
100% male demographic.
Well, where I have, yeah. Pretty much. Although we, you know, We do have spouses, and you know.
Okay, all right. Okay. But I mean, you're students. Like you do not teach at a co-ed.
Right. Right.
University,
yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Wabash is yes. Single sex.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, we have to be accurate. They are very tuned into the big games, right? They know what's coming. They pay very close attention to what's out now, what's on the way, what's on the horizon, right? And they've got their eye on BioShock Infinite, right? This is the big thing right at this particular moment. And you know, a few months ago, it might have been the latest Call of Duty, whatever. I'm around them all the time. I teach them in my courses. I talk about games like Journey. Very few of my students play those games. They're mostly console gamers, although there are some PC gamers. But sometimes I think the community that we kind of all exist in is kind of a salon, if you want to think of it that way, or kind of a boutique community. And this, we still are at this place where we have this really large segment of the consumer population that is kind of hardwired into waiting for the next big console or big PC exclusive, maybe a SimCity sort of game. And that they still really aren't tuned into the channel that many of us spend most of our time talking about. Do you see it that way? Will time just take care of that?
No, I don't think so. I think that all media are that way, right? Tony Scott and Manuela Dargis don't spend most of their time thinking about the Avengers. you know, they review it. Well, one of them does. It's certainly part of what they do. But, you know, the number of people who know what Amour is, which was nominated for a Best Picture, must be minuscule. Mm. And that's a movie that's distributed relatively widely. Certainly something like Meek's Cutoff, which you may remember from a year or two ago, which Dargis gave a rave for in the Times on a Friday and then prompted a lot of conversation because of a follow-up essay in the Times Magazine by Dan Coys about about difficult media, is a movie that, you know, I don't know how to quantify it, but that literally almost nobody has heard of, right? So, I'm sure the same is true of books, the same is true of most everything, which doesn't mean there aren't really excellent big-budget games. But even to a film critic, a really excellent big-budget prestige picture is in some level something to look their nose down on at some level, right? Like, Oscar bait is not – that's not a phrase with positive connotations.
Right. Yeah, I agree. You know, like, it's – if you – take a guess how many people have read Twilight versus how many have read like Adventures of Cavalier Clay or whatever, right? Like, I mean, it's always the way it's going to be. But I think that at least in games, probably in music these days as well, though I don't know, I don't even want to get into music and digital sales and stuff. But the thing that I think is great about our evolving paradigm for selling games is that if you do have a game like Journey or, you know, like Dear Esther or something, it's not a game that maybe most of the students in your class are going to have like heard of on their own and run out to buy. It's a niche game that appeals to a relatively specific, relatively small number of players. But through digital distribution and through social networks that allow you to connect to other people who care about the same kinds of things you do, niche games now have much more of an ability to reach like every single person in that niche than they used to. And so even if you make a game that only 100,000 people are ever going to care about, all 100,000 of those people can actually hear about and find and buy your game, which 10 years ago or whatever was definitely not true. And so I think that that's part of the reason that smaller indie games are becoming more viable now than they used to be. And as a creator, it's really encouraging not to have to worry about, oh, is my game that isn't, you know, Call of Duty or whatever going to have to compete for shelf space with all of those games so that people can even get their hands on it? Because the shelf space on the internet is unlimited. So I don't think the high level thing that you're talking about is going to change, but the ability to for people to find stuff that is outside the mainstream is just going up and up.
Yeah, and there is this wonderful kind of convergence of people. The community is connected to the creators in more intimate ways. I'm guessing the day that your game comes out, you know, you'll be on Twitter. People will actually be able to talk to you about it immediately, right? And we'll talk to each other about it. This is happening in real time with social media. We are all kind of sort of leveraged for our own purposes.
Yeah.
And that's pretty special.
It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, of course.
I wouldn't want to be Ocean Quigley, the creative director of SimCity on Twitter right now. But on the other hand, you know, yeah, I mean, it's really great. Even now, you know, even in like the last week or whatever, just to get a Twitter at reply from somebody out of the blue that just says, hey, I just played through Minerva's Den finally, and I really liked it, and I wanted to thank you for making it or whatever. Like, that's, you know, people have gotten, you know, fan mail in the mail forever or whatever, but like, that's only past a certain threshold. And now anyone that makes anything that connects with other people, the players can actually find the creators and reach out to them and say, hey, here's a thought that I had about this thing that you made. And it's great to have that dialogue in this kind of like distributed, you know, two-way fashion.
So I want to pitch a cynical point of view at you and give me your feedback on whether you think this is accurate or not. So we've got two big consoles coming out. They're coming to developers who don't want them, and they're aimed at consumers who don't want them. I can't imagine, and Chris, you and I both go back a long way. I can't imagine a time where there's been less enthusiasm for the next big thing. That the Wii U, as far as I can tell, I'm the only person I know in my neighborhood that owns one. Which, as a Nintendo product, that's unthinkable. Are you kidding me? Like any other Nintendo product from some years back, you know, you get it and your neighbor has it and your buddy has it and your cousin has it, you know?
I bet a bunch of your students have original Wiis, and I bet not many of them have a Wii U.
I would say the disconnect started around the Wii, though, even then, where, you know, it became a demographic thing where maybe their parents got one, but they didn't get one. But, yeah, you know, once that all got sorted out. But I just find it this odd, really odd time where it feels like a bunch of really high-powered corporate types are pushing stuff in a direction they want everything to go, where there doesn't seem to be any demand or very little demand that I can tell. Am I right about that, or am I seeing it wrong?
Among people I know, I agree with you. I don't have a great way of judging like the broader feeling about it. Like, I get the impression a lot of people cared about the PlayStation 4 reveal conference. Like, I don't know, there seemed to at least be a lot of coverage and a lot of buzz around it, but I haven't paid enough attention to, you know, whatever, the comment boards on IGN to see what kind of a broader audience thinks about it. It does seem like, to me, with the distribution, or with the continuing broadening of distribution methods for games, that any single console is inherently less relevant than it was, you know, 6 years ago when the last generation came out. I think that, yeah, there's a narrowing, you know, like the consoles are aimed more and more at the hardcore. And so it just means that their audience is going to get more and more specific. And that's probably not super healthy in the long run, but that's for those consoles in specific. It's not super healthy in the long run. I think it's very healthy for the industry at large.
Hmm. What do you think, Chris?
I mean, these are good questions that I'm wholly unequipped to answer, but I will answer them anyway.
You've got a microphone in front of you, so, you know, that makes
somebody
you an expert.
Somebody has you on a podcast.
You're an expert.
In the long run, we're probably headed for, you know, just like we're in the transition to a post-PC universe, we're headed toward a sort of post-console universe where all games will live in the cloud and you connect with them through some kind of singular device, whether it's actually your television or an Xbox or a PlayStation or a PC or a Steam box or your cable box, for all I know, right? We're headed towards something, but that is a long way away, at least within the time frame of someone who runs a corporation, right? That employs people and pays them and makes money and does all those things. I do think people are pretty satisfied with their current consoles in a way that would have been shocking, 8 years into a previous console life. I don't know if that's because of some kind of slowdown in Murphy's Law or something, that we're not so wowed by our Moore's Law. Yeah. We're not incredible, you know, because previously what would happen, right, is you would have this console and then your computer was just so much more sophisticated that you could not, you know, as a longtime console gamer, eventually the PC gamers were right, that they were like, well, my PC is so much better than what you have, but then they would produce something else for you. And you'd be like, well, yeah, but my thing is easy and it connects to my television and I can lean back and all that stuff. So why that is, I don't know. Maybe it is just the fact that they're connected to the internet and I can download these things and update them. But You're right. I mean, I have a Wii U. I reviewed it positively. I enjoy it. But I don't know anybody who has one. I think it's too early to tell what's going to happen with it. But certainly, I think if you're an average person who remembers that the Wii was this big phenomenon, you are currently aware that the Wii U is not a big national phenomenon, right? And that people aren't desperate to buy one. They aren't selling them on eBay. You're not thinking about your child's birthday and running around to various stores trying to find one. That's not happening.
Yeah.
But why that is, your guess is as good as mine. And what that means for the Xbox and PlayStation, your guess is as good as mine. I do think in the hardcore gamers' minds, which is a lot of the early adopters, the Xbox and PlayStation brands are stronger than the Wii brand right now, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe there'll be more interest in them. We'll certainly find out. Mm.
Yeah, what I'm hearing both of you say, though, in a way, is that it's not – we used to be a herd, you know, that you could kind of track, and we're lots of different herds now. We're just all based on what we own or what kind of games we're interested in or what our allegiances are. Or I know people who are just absolutely addicted to – Steam, and they wait for the latest sales, and they look for what's happening there, and they're almost 100% of their gaming experience is all about Steam. It's inside that ecosystem. And I know other people who don't even have Steam accounts and who do all kinds of gaming. And then my sister, for example, she's a pretty avid gamer too. She doesn't own any consoles. She has an old rotten PC, but she's got her phone and she's got her, you know, this really cool iPad that she got for Christmas, right? It's hard to figure out what gaming is. You know, it seems like it's such a big, fat, wide thing. Maybe that's just a perfectly great thing. Maybe that's we should celebrate that. But it does kind of make it hard to be a critic who can talk with some sense about the game industry, you know, or like the game's landscape. It's just, it's crazy wide and crazy complicated to now, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I know we've talked about it a lot here, it's almost something I try to avoid, right? Like I don't want to confuse the industry with the medium, because the reason I have the great blessing of being allowed to write in the arts section of the New York Times about video games is because it's a place to talk about games as something other than commerce.
Right.
So there certainly are these issues are important and they matter, and they certainly they matter for players and they matter for people who make games. But as a critic, I'm interested in them and how they affect the medium, the art form, the entertainment product. And I certainly have sympathy for people who lose their jobs and envy for people who become millionaires. But I don't regard it as my job to really have a mastery of these subjects.
That's a good transition point, because I was hoping to move in that direction anyway. How do you see a game? Well, you mentioned Papo Nyo. Maybe that's a good example, but maybe you could think of another game. This is for both of you to consider. What is it that games can do currently that excites you? How do you find yourself responding to the kinds of games that are available to you now, or maybe the ones that are on the horizon that sort of strike a chord with you? What are they doing to you or for you that make that important to you? I know that's a big question, but I hope you understand what I'm asking.
As you know, games can do lots of things, many of them are exciting. I do think, as Steve said at the outset here, that I mean, last year in particular was there were all these words. I don't know if it was a watershed or a tipping point or a sea change or a you know, whatever these other for independent games. But the number of games that are easily acquirable that give you the sense of a personal creator behind them or a small team that still manages to have a singular vision is interesting. And what Papo did with the idea, while it wasn't nonfiction, to sort of faint in the direction of the possibility of games as memoir, games as an expression of one's personal experience, was I thought extraordinary. I actually think it's quite interesting. And maybe this is only because I played the PlayStation version, but the differing reactions between The Walking Dead and Papo and Yo, I thought was noteworthy, because there were some criticisms of Papo for its sort of technical limitations. And while I adored The Walking Dead, I found it an incredibly glitchy mess, right? With the filmic equivalent of boom mics hanging down into the frame while you're playing it, and that didn't really affect my admiration for it. I did on some level, right? And sure, I had some issues with the platforming in Papo and Yo, but nothing that altered my admiration for it.
Just to answer your earlier question, the thing I would say is that I feel like I'm always looking for novel experiences that have that you can read, like you were saying, Chris, this kind of like personal take, you know, emanating from it, like the creator's outlook or obsessions or personality coming out of the game, and that above or, you know, in parallel with all that is executed extremely well, you know. And I think that that is something that, you know, when you have those three qualities together, it's a game experience that really stands out to me. And, you know, sometimes some of those aspects outweigh the others. Like, if you have something that's extremely novel and extremely personal and engaging on that level and not super well executed, you know, that can make up for it if you really connect to it on a personal level. But I'm always just, you know, looking for something that's new and different and personal and made by somebody who really knows how to make a game well, you know, that I feel like it's well designed and its interactive dialogue with the player is fluid and it's enjoyable to interact with while you're also getting something out of it that clearly came from another human being that you're having this kind of dialogue with. And yeah, I do think that there have been a lot of good examples of that lately. I also think that there have always been good examples of that, but the ability for those things to get made and get to people has just increased recently, which is exciting to me. And, you know, when you talk about, for instance, Papo and Yo versus Walking Dead, for me personally, with Papo, I didn't connect strongly enough with it to overcome the negative aspects of the execution that I encountered, whereas with The Walking Dead, the personal connection, the dialogue, and the stuff that was expressed through the characters and the situations overcame any of the, you know, like lack of polish that there might have been in the production. So it's all a balance. But I'm glad that when I seek out those kinds of experiences, it just seems like there's more and more of them these days.
How do the values that you were just describing, what you're looking for in games and how they strike you as meaningful, how are you plowing those into your own work currently?
We're trying to do a good job at all of them. I don't know. I mean, it's the kind of thing where it's like you can play a game that is just a really well-made game and you just enjoy it because of how well-made it is. You know, like you play something that has no personal veneer to it at all, but it's just such a joy to interact with that, you know, that's all you need. And it's great. And there are tons of games going back to, I don't know, even prior to Tetris, but maybe Tetris is like the best early example of just this thing that you interact with it and that's why you love it. But you know, for us on Gone Home, obviously we're focusing a lot more on the story and character voice side of it as far as like what the big investment in our content is going into. But my values as a designer point back towards like immersive sims like Thief and System Shock and Deus Ex and games that are very hands-off of forcing the player to do anything and try to only speak to the player through the rules, through the consistent rules of the game world, and allow you just to be in a game world and say, okay, this is how these different things work and I will interact with them in a way that makes sense and I will pull the meaning out of the game that I get by, you know, putting effort into it and make those interactions like very fluid and very, you know, like get out of the player's way as much as possible so they can interact with the thing and not be distracted by us, you know, like grabbing the camera for a cutscene or having the inputs be unintuitive. You know, a lot of it is just the smoothness of the very low level movement and the intuitiveness of interacting with stuff and the consistency of this always does this and that always does that and there aren't any exceptions that are going to surprise me and like break my immersion by saying like, oh, I thought that a light switch, you know, always worked this way, but in this case it doesn't. You know, just avoiding all of those pitfalls that can lead me as a player of other people's games to say like, oh, that broke me out of the experience. Because I think, yeah, if you can just maintain this kind of interactive suspension of disbelief and then give people an experience that they find inherent value in, that's the best that we can hope for with the kind of game that we're making.
Yeah.
And this is a really excellent year for games so far, by the way. I mean, I don't know if it's because everyone's cramming to get stuff out before these new consoles come out, but like this is the most loaded March I can ever remember. I'm very excited about about Gears of War, the new Gears of War game, just because I want to see what, you know, Tom Bissell, who we all know, you know, wrote a book about why video games are great, even though their writing is so terrible. And now he wants to put his money where his mouth is. That's great. Let's try that. BioShock Infinite's coming out. The new Tomb Raider is interesting, although there's an excessive amount of crate smashing in it. there's other interesting stuff. The hardest thing about my job right now is I find it, not my job, but my, this freelance gig I have, is I find it impossible to write about. There's so much good stuff that I can't possibly write about as much of it as I want to.
Yeah, and it's such a crazy collection of styles and types of play, too. That's, for me, that's what's especially exciting. I'm playing Etrian Odyssey. I'm playing MLB The Show. I'm playing Tomb Raider. I'm playing Amnesia.
Had you not played through Amnesia
before? No, I don't know why, but I just never got around to it. That's just off the top of my head. Yeah, but that list I just named, I mean, my God, what common ground is there? They're all games, I guess, you know?
definitely.
It's really astonishing.
They're interactive systems of some kind, right?
Yeah, they're interactive. I'm not even sure if, this term games, maybe that's something we should talk about too, but probably that's a whole different can of worms. Do you have time for one more question?
I do.
Sure.
One of the things I know that you've been interested in doing, Steve, is getting people to look at your game and give you feedback on it. It's sort of the natural process of developing a game. And I'm curious about the connection between critical feedback and the development process. Do you see, Chris, a role, I mean, do you keep your distance as a critic from the people who make the game sort of purposefully, or is there a role for being more connected with the people who are making the games from your point of view?
I think I'm too ignorant of game making to keep myself that purposefully connected with it. Every time I've written a magazine story or something about people who make games, it's helped me at least get some kind of window into the process. And I've even just doing interviews. I did an interview with Dan Houser about Grand Theft Auto V that was incredibly interesting to me. You know, I was only able to use some of it in a Q&A, but I got to talk to him for 2.5 hours about games and why he makes games and what he wants to achieve with them. The same is true of Ken Levine, BioShock Infinite piece I did for Wired, or a piece I did about the Medal of Honor reboot in the New York Times Magazine a while back. Like, I do want to maintain some kind of critical perspective, but as a journalist, any reporter faces these challenges, right? And you could decide to sort of abstract yourself entirely from that universe and just be a guy or a woman in a room communing with a screen and writing about these things. But I think that the medium is, even though it's 40 years old or even older than that, it's still so new and so fast moving and changing. And I don't have great technical skills that it's helpful to me to talk to people who make games. I can't imagine doing the job without doing that.
Is that why you're going to GDC this year?
Yeah, I just want to hear what people are, you know, what the industry, people in the industry, I've always wanted to go. They're sending me, so I'm going, you know, so, you know, it's useful to hear what people in the industry are talking about and thinking about in a time. I do wonder sometimes, and you guys would know more about this than I do, but I've been to E3, you know, I'm going to GDC. I do wonder what would a real, even though GDC is a wonderful event, it doesn't serve the function of what a real film festival serves, which is like, here's a chance to see stuff either in the works or that is about to come out for real aficionados to feel them, right? Like, one's a trade show and another is for people in the industry, but there's no event, and this mythical event that I would want, but there's no, you know, there's no con or New York Film Festival of video games. And I don't know what that would look like, but that's the event that I'd like to see.
I mean, you might be interested in looking up IndieCade, which, you know, it doesn't cover the entire industry because it doesn't have AAA stuff in it. But I mean, most film festivals don't have a lot of big Hollywood releases in them either. I think they're actually doing they've started up IndieCade East as well, because IndieCade has been in LA up to now, but I think they're also going to do a branch in New York.
Yeah, they did it at the Museum of the Moving Image. I really wanted to go, but I ended up being out of town that weekend.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean, that's the kind of thing where it is either up and coming or recently released games of all different stripes, and it is open to the public, and you can go around and play them and talk to the creators, and it's pretty cool from the point of view you were talking about, though it's not anywhere near as formalized as a film festival, but I think that kind of comes down to the form that games take versus the form films.
Yeah. Well, and unlike Sundance, you know, you can't talk to the creator kind of like as you're experiencing the thing, which is
That's right.
amazing yeah. part of IndieCade. You're playing it, and this person is watching you closely as it's unfolding, and he or she's heavily invested in what's happening for you, and your resource is standing right there to answer any question you have. It's pretty unbelievable.
And you'll find that experience at the IGF pavilion at the GDC Expo, because yeah, the creator is there with their game while you're playing it, and you can ask them about it and stuff. So that is also pretty cool. But it is only if you're in the industry or have someone paying your way.
I'll have so much performance anxiety. I can't even imagine.
I know. It's true. I rarely play there because I find I can find out everything I need to know by watching other people play. I don't like people watching me play games, to be honest. Yeah. So, Steve, what about from your perspective, how does that work with you and the critical dimension of games, the feedback that you get?
Well, I think that you brought up two concepts that are very separate for me, one of which is doing playtests with, like, internal playtests with people that we know, either people that we worked with in the past or other developers that we know personally that we can send, you know, an unfinished build to and say, play through this and give us your feedback and let us know what didn't work for you and stuff, versus exposing the game to journalists, which I personally think it's important to keep a clear separation between those two things, because I don't want to muddy the waters as far as what kind of relationship, you know, we as developers have with the journalists. Because, you know, like it is super great. I love talking to journalists and having them play the game and talk to them about, you know, what they thought about it and doing an interview and giving them insight into how we made it and all that kind of stuff. But that's when we have something that we are ready to kind of show publicly and be evaluated for what it is, and not something that we intend to use to like shape the game, you know, going forward. Because like developers that we know, we want their opinion and we want to say like, what should we fix? How should we, you know, how should we update this? How would this be better? Whereas for a journalist, it's kind of like, We love to talk to them about it and hear what they think about it. But there's this weird barrier where I don't want to get to a point where it seems like we're soliciting a journalist for how we should make our game so that they would like it more. Right. You know, because that just seems really weird.
Seems like a terrible idea.
Yeah, I can imagine a few reviewers who, if they hated it, you knew you did it right.
True enough. But that said, you know, all I'm saying is it is great to have both journalists and other developers get their hands on the game and talk to us about it and have a dialogue about it. I just think that there are two different roles for those kinds of discussions, depending on who you're talking to.
Well, this time has just flown by. I thank both of you for giving me so much of your time and attention. This has been great. It's been terrific having you on the show, Chris. I hope I can get you on again and we can chat about games in the future.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. And I'll see you at GDC for sure. Steve, I'll see you there too.
Yeah. No, it was great talking to you, Michael. Thanks for having me back on the podcast.
Of course. And everyone keep your eye out for Gone Home. Do you have any window of release date possibilities that you're thinking about?
We're just looking at the second half of this year, but we don't have anything more specific than that.
Okay, great. Well, we'll maybe have you back on and we can chat about it after it's released. That'd be fun.
That would be great.
All right. Well, thanks again to both of you, and I will talk to you again soon, and happy gaming.